Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. Coming up on today's program, Dayton Youth Radio and WISO's occasional art series, Culture Couch. And from Bots to Bach, we've got a lot more for you. Up first, in the past few years, the Montgomery County Jail has become notorious for lawsuits and allegations of inmate mistreatment. A recent independent investigation by the Montgomery County Commission's Justice Committee revealed a chronic shortage of corrections officers contributes to some of the jail's most deeply entrenched problems. The solution may seem obvious: hire more corrections officers. But some jail officials say it's not that simple. Here's WISO's April Leslie.
If the Montgomery County Sheriff's Office could design the perfect corrections officer, they'd probably be a lot like Andrew Rhodes. Rhodes is an easygoing Miami Valley native who's been on the job at the county jail for about a year. He's got a big smile and is quick to laugh, but he's serious about what he does.
I guess I get the most out of helping the inmates. They're at their lowest point, and we're there to take care of them and to give them what they need, and a lot of times we're the only people they have at that moment, and it's very rewarding.
Rhodes says he spent much of his life dreaming of becoming a police officer. He finally made the switch to corrections after a decade working in an unrelated field. He says he hopes this is the beginning of a long career in law enforcement. Recently appointed Sheriff Rob Streck wants to recruit more people like Rhodes, but it's been hard to find them. The Justice Committee report recommended hiring over 50 new corrections officers at the jail. But the sheriff says he struggles to fill existing vacant positions as it is. Streck says it's particularly difficult to recruit candidates of color. 80% of the jail's staff is white, although nearly 40% of the inmate population is black.
The county commission could turn around tomorrow and say, okay, we're going to allot you this much money to add this many more bodies, and I'm already short now. So how do we go about filling those positions? And yes, it keeps me up at night.
Jail understaffing can lead to safety issues. With fewer people keeping eyes on inmates, violence, health problems, and other critical issues could go unnoticed. Jail overcrowding compounds the problem. And the Justice Committee report found understaffing leads to forced overtime, decreasing employee morale. But Sheriff Streck says a strong economy means fewer people are looking for jobs across the board. The drug epidemic has also hampered their recruitment efforts.
We need somebody with a nice, clean background. Drug use in the past is a huge issue for us. It's a huge issue for everybody. And we're not going to lower our standards just because we're short on people.
Streck also says there's an image problem. It's just hard to find people who want to work in a jail. It's a problem nationwide, according to Carlisle Holder. He worked in management for the Federal Bureau of Prisons for nearly 30 years and is now a consultant.
Corrections is always a difficult sell because of the nature of the job. You know, it's confined. It's not as glorious as being a police officer or a sheriff.
Holder says the career isn't for everyone. COs need to be extremely disciplined and able to communicate well with inmates. The job also requires long hours. Officer Andrew Rhodes, who is a father of twin toddlers, says that's been the hardest part of the job for him.
I spend a lot of time at the jail, and I miss out on some stuff. So that's what people need to realize is we spend Christmases with the inmates. We spend, you know, weekends, nights away from our families.
Rhodes would eventually like to join the police force. That's the case for many other COs. The job is often a stepping stone to other higher paid careers in law enforcement. It's one reason why the turnover rate among jail corrections officers is so high. In Montgomery County, that rate is 28%. So what can be done to attract new corrections officers and keep them on the job? Carlisle Holder says while there's no easy answer, sheriff's departments need to do a better job of reaching out to potential applicants at universities and veterans events. He also says jail leaders should conduct exit interviews with COs to find out why they chose to leave.
We are facing a challenge in terms of getting young people to understand the value of a career in correction and the social impact, you know, to convince people that although they made a mistake, they can still rebuild their lives through how we treat them. They're being treated with dignity and respect while they're incarcerated.
Montgomery County Sheriff Rob Streck says the department is planning to launch a new recruitment initiative in the coming months. For WYSO, I'm April Leslie.
Remember the last federal government shutdown? That was more than 2 months ago, but its impact is still reverberating in the kitchens of some rural Ohioans. WOSU's Nick Evans visited a Southeast Ohio food pantry to see how people are managing.
Just off the main drag in Nelsonville sits the food cupboard, and volunteers are busy loading up boxes with staples for the noon rush.
We have the cereal, and we have spaghetti. We have peanut butter, vegetables.
Margaret Chesky and her husband Larry Lafferty run the pantry, which serves residents throughout Athens County. Chesky explains February is typically their slowest month.
That didn't happen this year. Our numbers were equal to other months in February, and we serve usually between 600 and 700 families a month at this food pantry. So there was no dip last February.
They point to the federal government shutdown as the culprit. Although the president and Congress reached a truce back in January, Lafferty explains the dispute disrupted SNAP payments. That's the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, what used to be known as food stamps.
So there were times, I think, when SNAP was available, when they received additional SNAP dollars that they normally wouldn't, with really as an advance on what was coming, it was spent. And then there was deprivation. Then they didn't have it when they normally would, and they normally would need it.
In mid-January, Ohio's Department of Job and Family Services distributed February's dollars early under the direction of federal officials. Then, in hopes of not leaving recipients completely broke, they split the next month into two staggered payments. No one wound up losing any money, but that split payment means many cupboards are now going empty. Imagine switching from a monthly paycheck to every other week, and then back.
People have been coming to this pantry who haven't been here in a while, kind of indicating, you know, that this going to a pantry is a last resort, but recently they've, you know, it's been necessary.
Closer to Columbus, providers haven't seen the same uptick. But David Keller from the Southeast Ohio Food Bank says the same story is playing out in pantries across the 10-county region they serve. Keller says the network saw 500 more pantry visits in February this year than the last. And one of the biggest increases came from seniors.
You know, there's a lot of talk right now going on about, oh, the economy's recovering, people have well-paying jobs. We see that in metropolitan areas. That does not necessarily trickle out to rural Appalachian Ohio, which is the area that we serve.
Tammy Exline says the increased traffic in Nelsonville has been hard to miss.
There's, like, last week, I couldn't even get in here. There was a line at 11 o'clock waiting to get in here, a line clear up there to Shriver's drugstore a block away.
She's holding a bag of groceries in each hand, with more tucked into the stroller with her kids. SNAP payments return to normal in April, and Exline hopes that gets her family back on a normal footing.
Yeah, that's what I got marked on my calendar, but who knows?
For Ohio Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks so much for joining us. This week on Dayton Youth Radio, we have a story that helps us understand what teenagers go through when they struggle with depression. It's from Thurgood Marshall, STEM High School. And a note to listeners, this story addresses suicidal thoughts. Here's Project Coordinator Basim Blunt.
For African-American teenagers, suicide is the third leading cause of death. But many are afraid to seek help, let alone talk about it on the radio.
Instead of feeling alone in a group, it's better to have real solitude all by yourself.
Hi, my name is Masad Patterson, and I'm an 18-year-old senior student at Thurgood Marshall STEM High School. Today, I'll be telling a story about depression. Depression can make you feel tired, unfocused, and unmotivated to do even the simplest tasks. I've been depressed for about as long as I can remember, and it's caused quite a few issues with how I've dealt with things such as trying to enjoy my time on a field trip, how I socialized with my peers, or going to family events and being chastised for not being into the party and smiling. I remember one day where I had lied to my mom about being sick because I was just too depressed to want to even get out of bed or leave the house. I did my best to fight my way out of these episodes by burying myself in things that I loved, gaming, arts and crafts. I felt like a large weight was on my body, so I started lifting it for exercise. I was hearing voices, seeing things, and felt empty almost every single day. So I took those voices and used them for my own purposes. I created new characters like Soda Can Jones. I couldn't escape violent thoughts, so I played video games like Doom and Devil May Cry. I would do my best to keep my head up and surround myself with the things I loved and the people that cared. But it got worse. My depression got so bad that I had been to the hospital 3 different times, all for suicidal thoughts. They were nice to me at the hospital, but that's just them doing their job. I did learn quite a few things in the hospital. I learned a lot of, what do they call them again? I learned a lot of techniques, coping mechanisms, coping skills. Many creators turned all their bad situations into good ones. Some writers only got that way because writing was their escape from real life. Artists, gamers, actors, all came from somewhere and discovered their passion some way. Fast forwarding to the present, and now I'm feeling much better. Graduation is about to come up, and my mother, father, brothers, and sister get to see me walk across the stage. I can't wait for the next chapter of my life to open. Going to college, all the way out in Utah. It's a really far away journey, but hey, it's where I want to go. I want to go to college for video game design. I want to be a video game designer. If I hadn't gotten the help and medicine that I required from the hospital, if I hadn't surrounded myself with things that I loved, if I hadn't turned those bad situations into good qualities, then I wouldn't be here to tell you my story or to let you know to keep your head up and relax. You'll find that one thing that'll bring you some peace. Depression isn't a fixed thing. It's malleable. You can manipulate it. I can do this now, like, my own way. Hey, I can take my life back. For Dayton Youth Radio at Thurgood Marshall STEM High School, this is Masad Patterson.
That's a story entitled If, written and produced by Masad Patterson, a senior from Thurgood Marshall STEM High School. Special thanks to Nathan Shields. For Dayton Youth Radio, this is Basim Blunt.
Find more stories on our website at WISO.org. Support for Dayton Youth Radio comes from the Virginia W. Kettering Foundation and the Ohio Arts Council. I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WISO Weekend. Well, today is the birthday of Johann Sebastian Bach, March 31st. The Bach Society of Dayton is performing one of his masterworks later today, a piece called St. Matthew Passion. It's been billed as the most significant choral composition in classic music, and with good reason. In order to perform it, the Bach Society Choir will be partnering with the University of Dayton Chorale, as well as dozens of professional musicians and singers to tell the story of Jesus' crucifixion. Community Voices producer Jason Reynolds has more.
2 and 3. Those are two. Up, up, B. 2 and 3.
That's John Neely, musical director for the Bach Society of Dayton. He's leading both the Bach Society Choir and the University of Dayton Chorale in their first joint rehearsal for St. Matthew Passion. Neely stands in front of a grand piano while a team sets up platforms and chairs for all the singers.
It's a high mark Johann Sebastian Bach piece. It has double chorus, it has two orchestras, and superb soloists coming from various parts of Ohio and beyond. Just worth every minute of the 2 hours plus.
Tonight, there's no orchestras and no soloists. It's just the two choruses. But that's still 100 people. And the choruses have yet to rehearse together.
Right where you start, please. Right at 66 feet. Okay? And we go.
For the performers, this piece is both a point of pride and problematic. Sharon Norton is a member of the Bach Society and a singer. She says it's not just all those people singing, but that they're singing so many different parts.
You have 9 soloists, and it's in German. The only thing we don't have to do is stand on our head when we sing. That would probably, you know, add the complexity. But it fits together, and you'll hear it, and it's just beautiful. I think it's great that we can perform something so epic here in Dayton.
Norton loves the majesty of the piece. And when the University of Dayton Chorale arrived, she was ready to start singing.
Here comes the UD students, so.
Are you excited to sing with all these young people?
I am, and we had the opportunity to collaborate earlier this year with Central State University, and it was a phenomenal experience.
That's one of the Bach Society's missions, to get more young people involved in music, and not just Bach. When they partnered with Central State, a historically black college, they put on a program of spirituals called Songs of Hope and Freedom. Now, they're partnering with the University of Dayton, a Catholic college, to perform the story of Jesus' crucifixion from the book of Matthew, with Easter approaching. Here are UD sophomores Claire Carey and Maggie Fetter.
Honestly, it's one of the hardest choral pieces you can do in a lifetime, and it's like really wild that we're doing it now.
It's one of the most intense things that I've ever done. I've never sang a work entirely in German like this. It's really, whew, it's a big one.
Fetter says that classical music in general, and Bach in particular, is a great starting point for anyone interested in music.
It underlies all modern music. In order to really write detailed, good stuff, you have to know how to do it. And that comes from the older stuff. That comes from Bach. Bach was the first person to write counterpoint.
What's a counterpoint?
That's a great question. Yeah, it's kind of like how the soprano, alto, tenor, and bass lines, they all interact with each other. In the music theory world, there's like rules that Bach kind of made up. Like, he was the first person to do it, and then theorists came along later and said, wow, this is really good, and he does it pretty consistently, so we're going to make this the school of thought.
Stephen Henkel directs the University of Dayton Chorale. His students have been working on this since January, rehearsing, listening to tape, learning German diction. He says he sees big epiphanies on the horizon for these young performers.
You know, for them, a lot of them, they haven't really gotten a chance to ever sing something like this at this magnitude. So to do this, to do all Baroque music for most of the semester, it was a challenge for a lot of them. But I think now they're going to see, as it comes together with the other choirs, then when the orchestra comes and the soloists come, they're going to say, bing, oh, this is what it is, you know. So it's been different ways trying to motivate them throughout the semester, trying to just remind them that this is a service and they should be excellent because they are sharing the gift of music with the community.
This is just the fifth time that St. Matthew Passion has been performed in Dayton in the last 70 years. But the Bach Society of Dayton put it on just 5 years ago. That means they have a unique knowledge of what these kind of collaborations take. They also say that the program, that little pamphlet you get when you walk in the door, is key. It has the German on one side and the English on the other, so everyone can follow the story of the crucifixion, while the choruses and the orchestras and the soloists put their passion into the performance. For Culture Couch at WYSO, I'm Jason Reynolds.
Culture Couch is made possible by a generous grant from the Ohio Arts Council. Thanks for joining us this Sunday morning. I'm Jerry Kenny. So on my to-do list here at WISO, there are a couple of stories on issues local manufacturers are facing, such as a shortage of welders and other skilled laborers. In gathering information about these stories, we talked with one manufacturer who told us about a program they're involved in to get younger people interested in some of those skilled trades. Steve Staub with Staub Manufacturing Solutions of Dayton, along with other local companies, started a program called Extreme STEM, which pairs local youth with area manufacturers for an event that's geared toward lighting the fires of ingenuity in young people. Staub gave us the details earlier this week.
We have a program we call Extreme Bots, and it's just like you see on TV where the robots go into arena and beat the tar out of each other. Team members get paired with a manufacturing company, and they help design and build the bot. That the team does it. The company just helps provide support and a little mentorship. But it gives kids an opportunity to see what STEM careers are available and see what's available in the manufacturing industry and help get them interested in things that they might not be learning about in school.
So it ties back to the issue that we talked about earlier, a shortage in workforce development, but this has got to be fun.
It's a lot of fun just to see the teams compete. So we have two competitions a year tied with the school year. The first one is usually in November, December timeframe. And so the teams usually start building about the time school starts. They bring their bot out, or sometimes they just don't get it done in time. But they'll bring it out and they'll do really well. Some get destroyed. You know, there's a real wide variety. But then the concept is they can learn from their mistakes and come back in the April competition and have a better bot and compete again and see how well they do. We've had teams that have been absolutely clobbered in the fall and come back in the spring and have done really well. But it gives them an opportunity, and it's great teamwork. They're working together. They're learning engineering skills and STEM skills, and they're really, and we always joke, they learn crisis management when their bot gets the tar beat out of it. They have about a half hour to try to get it back and again to go for another round.
A lot of the challenges that you deal with every day as a manufacturer.
In life in general, you know, we all need to know how to work together as a team and solve problems. That's what this teaches, real life hands-on experience with that.
What schools are you working with? You've got high school and college categories right now?
Correct. We've got schools, the high school teams, we've got folks from Troy City Schools, Troy Christian, we've got Centerville, we've got Kettering. We've really got a wide variety of schools from around our region. We've got a few from the Cincinnati area. And our goal is to grow this. And next year, we hope to have teams from Lima through Cincinnati. And we really want to grow this throughout the state. It's working. The folks are excited about it. And there's a lot of other hands-on things to do if people show up, even just to watch it. But we also have a 3D printing competition. Where if you're a middle schooler and you want to show up and watch the bots but something else to do, we've got all kinds of hands-on exhibits for the kids to be part of, but we also have a 3D printing where they can walk in and they can design and print their own wind turbine blade, 3D printed. And then we'll put it in a wind tunnel test and see how fast it goes. And then we'll see who has the fastest one at the end of the day, and they can change it and they can do different things to it. But there again, it gets them interested. Hey, there's a lot of STEM careers out there. There's opportunities. We can make a good living and have some fun doing it.
So tell me how often the kids and the manufacturers that they're partnered with work together, kind of what are the logistics of this and who you're working with as an example?
Most manufacturers get together with a team probably once a week. Some do it twice a week. I think it gets a little more often as it gets closer to the competition. They might not have it done in time. Our company, personally, we work with Troy Christian. We've worked with a couple other teams over the years, but it's fun just seeing the ideas they come up with. And we had a conversation with them on the phone this morning that they realize, oh, they need a couple more parts made. And so there, the kids actually design it and bring it down, and they said, here's what we need, and we help them make it.
That's pretty cool. So all this is going to unfold at the Nutter Center on April 6th. Are you pretty excited? I know. I bet the kids are.
We are, and this is going to be the largest competition we've had since it started. First battle is at 9 a.m. on Saturday. It's in the McClinn Gym there at Gate 9 at the lower part of the Nutter Center. And it usually goes till about mid-afternoon. It kind of narrows down. It's a double elimination. But it's just a heck of a lot of fun to watch. And the kids are just so excited about it.
Steve Staub with Staub Manufacturing Solutions. Thanks for your time and the information. Good luck with the upcoming challenge and some of the other challenges we've talked about today.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate it. And I hope you can make it out next Saturday and really appreciate the time to learn more about the industry. I appreciate it.
And you can find more about that program and the upcoming events at the Nutter Center at extremestem.org. I'm Jerry Kenny. This is WISO Weekend.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac for the last week of early spring, the final week of the cabbage white butterfly moon, and the first full week of the sun in Aries. No matter the weather, the end of March almost always means middle spring is right around the corner, and it could be a good time once again to count the weeks until summer. In average years, only 1 week or maybe even a few days remain until the yellow flowers of forsythia bloom. It's about 2 weeks until all the honeysuckles and lilacs flower. About 3 weeks until May apples push out of the ground, a sign that morel mushrooms are swelling in the night. It's about 4 weeks to the first cricket song of late spring and the emerging of praying mantises from their egg sacs, or uthecas, as they are called. It's about 5 weeks to the great warbler migration, the time when clovers bloom in the pastures and your lawn is, it's ready to cut. It's 6 weeks to the first strawberry pie, and it's 7 weeks until the first orange daylilies blossom by the roadsides. It's 8 weeks until roses flower, and almost all the leaves have emerged on the trees. 9 weeks until the first mulberries are sweet for picking and cottonwood cotton drifts in the wind. 10 weeks until wild black raspberries sweeten and fledgling robins peep in the bushes. This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the first week of middle spring and the first full week of the cows switching their tails moon. In the meantime, every year has its own timetable. But the more you count, the more you see.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at WYSO.org.
That's it for this edition of WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world. Since 1958, thanks to generous listeners like you. I'm Jerry Kenney. We'll be back next Sunday morning at 10. Up next on WYSO, it's Vic McCunis with the Book Nook.
Hey, have you heard about Next Up? We're a collective of curious minds, creative leaders, compassionate activists, and thoughtful critics. And Next Up is our way of cultivating the next generation of WISO, listeners, volunteers, and members. We're not trapped in the backseat of our parents' car listening to NPR anymore. We're listening now, on our own. We're next. Learn more at wiso.org/nextup.
Farming, it looks romantic. It really does. It's beautiful. It's seducing. But when you get out here and you're in the grit with it, your back's going to ache. You're going to have blisters. Your feet are going to hurt.
There's always a struggle to the year. The beautiful thing is every year is a new year and you get another chance next year, hopefully.
But you got to love it and want it.
I'm Renee Wild. Join me for County Lines, where we explore rural life on the air and online.